Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. And a warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening. If you are just joining me, you've missed a great first hour. You can always go to myfaithradio.com to hear the podcast. It's always available after the show. Much thanks to Carissa, who does that. Thank you so much. We've got a great hour coming up. Dr. Greg Borgon has agreed to stay and talk to me for a little while longer. We're talking about secular humanism and secularism and how it says in 2 Timothy 4:3, "For the time will come when men will not put up with sound doctrine. Instead, to suit their own desires, they will gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear." And there is a conflict, of course, in the world today. And secular humanism is a position. It's a religion, so to speak. So we're going to try to understand that. And Greg will help us make sense of that. If you are still thinking about coming on Thursday, we've got a live broadcast of Afternoons with Bill Arnold Thursday this week from 3 to 5 Central Standard Time right here at the University of Northwestern in the lovely media room here on first floor. There will be coffees and cookies and all kinds of fun to be had. You can have plenty of elbow room. If you like, you can come and watch the show. You can come late and leave early. You can stay for the whole 2 hours. You can do whatever you like. Just would love to have you come. And if you still think you want to come, go to myfaithradio.com, go to the Afternoons with Bill Arnold page and say, "Yes, reserve me a space." No cost. Just come and have fun. It'll be great. I'd love to meet you in person. I would love to shake your hand firmly while maintaining good eye contact. And I'll use your name multiple times in each sentence. You're going to feel very loved by me. Okay? All right. So we're going to take a little break. When we come back, Dr. Greg Borgon is still in studio with me. We're going to have him for the next half hour. We'll be back in a minute.
Hi, I'm Dick Whitworth, General Manager of Faith Radio. Recently, Mary sent us a note and said this: "I know that God loves us. I know that His mercies are new every morning. But I also know that He has called us to encourage one another, to help us get an understanding of love, forgiveness, grace, and the gift of eternal life. And Faith Radio helps me do just that. Thank you, Mary, and thank you, friends, for making stories like Mary's possible. Your ongoing monthly support of Faith Radio keeps us going and growing. Whether you listen over the air, online, or on demand, Faith Radio is delivering relevant Bible preaching and family-focused teaching thanks to you. If you're not already a member of the monthly support team, would you consider joining? You can give a gift today online at myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. Thank you again for listening. Thank you for praying and supporting this ministry. God bless you.
Welcome back. It's 7 minutes after the hour. Dr. Greg Borgon is in studio with me. He is a professor at both Bethel Seminary and also Bethel University and the University of Northwestern. And you're just teaching your last class tonight here on campus, aren't you?
So I'm looking forward to it.
You definitely want your mic on. There we go. It's on world religions?
Yes, on world religions.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And then I teach another class coming up on ministry and leadership.
Something I will never say. Okay, let's go back to our friend Matt, who called in from Burnsville. And you had another thing you wanted to say.
And Matt, if you're still listening, one other thing I wanted to share with you, to encourage you, is that God often does His greatest work at the inconvenient moments of our life, when we're not feeling prepared, when we're not feeling ready, when, frankly, we'd probably rather be doing something entirely different than being in that moment. But when we submit to Him in obedience and we lean into our fear — remember, courage has never been the absence of fear. It's always been the absence of self. When we set ourselves aside and engage, then God shows up in powerful ways. And you won't even probably remember everything you said in that moment when God takes over. But at the end of that inconvenient moment, you're glad that you engaged. So I would encourage you not to hesitate to engage and answer the questions they're asking or question the answers they're giving.
Don't you love it, Greg, how Jesus did so much of His ministry which appeared to disguise itself as an interruption.
Yeah.
He was always on his way somewhere, and he gets stopped, which is interrupted, right?
Yeah. But you notice what's interesting is you read the Gospels, he was never in a hurry.
That's true.
You don't see him or hear him running anywhere.
No.
As a matter of fact, in the middle of ministering to 5,000 people, what does he do? He gets in a boat and goes on the other side of the lake, and the rest of the disciples are standing there probably wondering what's going on. When they find him, he was purpose-driven. He says, don't you understand, you'll always have the poor before you and to minister to them, but I must be about my Father's business. Mm-hmm. He knew exactly why he was here on this earth.
Yeah, he took his time because he created time.
but not bound by it.
Right. All right, let's get back to our discussion about secular humanism. And I love that quote from 2 Timothy 4:3, how the time will come when men will not put up a sound doctrine, but instead, to suit their desires, they're going to gather around and listen to what their itching ears want to hear. That is the kind of almost the theme of this discussion, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
So people will go ahead and adopt to themselves. When they finally make that decision, whether it's overtly or covertly, that they want to live life on their own terms, then they spend the rest of their life justifying their behavior.
So
that's where secular humanism finds its way in. That's where it's easy for it to grasp onto your soul. And so consequently, when you make that decision, putting yourself on that throne of authority over what you believe and what you value, then you're an open book, or you're open to a worldview called secular humanism.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we get back to this discussion, I would love for you to go through your model of how it works, because I've used this before, but I'm going to let you do it because you're the pro.
Yeah.
But how important beliefs are, because beliefs will inform your values.
Yeah. Our central beliefs,
yeah.
The foundation which we stand on, they may not be what we necessarily verbally articulate, but they're what we actually believe at the core of who we are. Our central beliefs establish our values. Values are the filter through which you process every life decision, whether you can articulate them or not. Every decision of any consequence is based on a value you hold.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't give it order, or if you don't make a decision, what's going to stand in authority over it? Some days you make decisions that are honorable, and the next day you make decisions that are dishonorable. Central beliefs establish your values. Values inform your worldview, that set of perceptual attitudes you have about life, that lens through which you view life to try and make sense of what you're observing.
Mm-hmm.
It's how you connect the dots. So your central beliefs establish your values. Your values inform your worldview. Your worldview conditions your motives, what's going to compel you to move from thought to action.
Mm-hmm.
And so central beliefs establish your values. Your values inform your worldview. Your worldview conditions your motives, and your motives energize your behavior. And your behavior will always reflect the health of your heart, which these four components reside in Scripture, found over 800, and sometimes the word heart or a variation of the word heart is found in Scripture. So the idea is, if you want to know, really know, what somebody believes and what they truly value, that's even dealing with a secular humanist. They may, again, articulate a worldview that they're not even living by.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that you can always, regardless of a person's worldview, to determine what they truly believe and what they truly value is watch their behavior. Because over the course of time, their behavior will ultimately reveal what they truly believe, what they truly value, and what their worldview is. As I've said on your show in the past, if I could follow you around, Bill, and you didn't
Please
know
don't.
I was there for 3 weeks,
yeah.
I wouldn't have to hear a word you said. All I'd have to do is watch how you behaved. And at the end of that 3 weeks, with some degree of surety, I'd be able to come back and tell you what you truly believed and what you truly valued. Because you cannot keep up a persona for an extended period of time. You will always default to who you are at the core at a moment of weakness when you're tired or you're under pressure. So you're just watching somebody for 3 weeks. Now, how would you do that with a secular humanist? Look at their track record. Before you even engage them, if you have that opportunity, find out where the inconsistencies are, because it's often the case people verbalize a worldview that they don't truly believe in, but the way in which they live will determine that. That's something else I would have said to Matt, is that the fact of the matter is what has greater power than any argument that you can muster when dealing with somebody like a secular humanist is a life well lived. Nobody really cares what you have to say until they observe how you live. And if you live a life of integrity and honor under God's authority, over time, people ultimately want to hear what you have to say, even if they disagree with you. Why? Because they cannot get past a life well lived. They cannot deconstruct it. They can deconstruct what you say you believe. They can deconstruct what your worldview is. But what they can't deconstruct is a life well lived.
Yeah.
So if that person is in the workplace, that secular humanist that you're dealing with, how are you in that place, that workplace? How do you live your life out? That will gain an audience quicker than any crafted, well-crafted argument.
Mm-hmm. Well said. All right, let's talk a little bit more about secular humanism as it applies to things like judgment.
Well, humanists reject the concept of God's judgment, believing in the words of the ancient Greek Protagoras, I believe is how it's pronounced, that man is the measure of all things, of things that are, that they are, and of things that are not, and that they are not. Now, that sounds like a lot of gobbledygook, but the fact of the matter is that they don't want to be judged. For a Christian, we understand that we're going to appear before the judgment seat of Christ, not to determine whether or not we're going to heaven, but what we've done while we lived on earth, because God is expecting an ROI, a return on his investment.
Mm-hmm.
It, not like the servant who buried his talent in the ground and gave it back to him with no increase. And it says we're going to be rewarded for what we have done. But we're going to appear before the judgment seat of Christ. Those who have not received Christ as Savior nor are going to appear before the great white throne of judgment. Now, secular humanist wants none of that.
Right.
Because he figures or she figures they're the judge of their own destiny. They don't want anybody else judging them. And so they'll go ahead and live a life without boundaries simply because they won't allow anyone to judge them.
Or boundaries that they create, that they live by, which gives them some sort of feeling good about themselves.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. It's not that a secular humanist is totally evil.
Right.
And some of them have values that are commensurate or comparable to ours, a value for education, for instance. And so consequently, how they live that out, though, is totally different than a follower of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Greg, let me take a little break. It is 16 minutes after the hour. Dr. Greg Borgon is my guest. If you would like to jump into this discussion, you're welcome. 877-933-2484. Otherwise, bill@myfaithradio.com is a place you can also ask a question, and I'll ask Greg for you. Be back in just a minute. Back to the show. It's 18 minutes after the hour. Dr. Greg Borgon is my guest. He is in studio. He loves telling me that he's been to Ireland 8 times and I've only been 6. That is just not
eat
nice.
Eat your heart out, Bill.
That is not nice. I don't use the word evil very often, but that's evil.
It's my home away from home.
I know it is. We're talking about secular humanism. Let's talk about it and how it applies to behavioral standards, Greg.
Yeah, because humanists believe that God is not relevant to mankind and that humankind is the standard by which all things are judged, it follows then, as one author said, that for the humanist, mankind must set all standards of human behavior through science and reason. So on the other hand, for Christians, Christians believe that God made mankind, gives purpose and guidance to humanity, and will one day judge everyone. Then it follows that for Christians, only God can set the standard for human behavior. Another belief of secular humanists is that because humanists believe that people differ in their perspective and that no one's person's beliefs are inherently preferable to any others, and it follows that for humanists, an open society, as we had talked about earlier, must maintain pluralistic behavioral standards regarding truth, piety, virtue, and justice. So you have these pockets of values out there competing for one another, each defending themselves. For the Christian, that's different. We have a set of values that comes directly from the heart of God. And finally, when it comes to behavioral standards, because humanists believe that the standards of human behavior are derived from within human experience, and that the plurality of human beings and their experiences requires pluralistic standards and multiplicity of standards, then it follows that humanists, everyone in society, must be permissive and tolerant of every other person's standards of behavior, which makes it very interesting. Until, in real life, somebody's set of behavioral standards butts up against and confronts somebody else's set, and there's no movement, then what do you do? One is fighting over their standard versus the one in which they're confronting. So there isn't this, they're not going to be playing nice as a result.
Wow. All right, let's talk about sexual content.
Or conduct, yeah. Because humanists derive their standards of sexual conduct from human experiences, and since personal pleasure is the primary standard, like a hedonist or Epicurean, by which most humanists determine their sexual conduct, then it follows that for humanists, for instance, there should be no restraints upon sexual freedoms except as the person prefers. You can already see the danger in that. If any particular person in any given situation determines that fornication, whether it's adultery or incest, bestiality, homosexuality, lesbianism, or whatever, is right, then in that situation, for the humanist, it's considered all right. If to arouse sexual excitement and to make the experience more pleasurable, hardcore pornography is used, then that too, for humanists, it's all right, because it's your own special interest. It's whatever makes yourself feel good. Now, on the other hand, because Christians believe that God gives the standard by which humanity must live, and because that standard says you shall not commit adultery, and other like statements, then it follows that for Christians, illicit sexual thoughts and behavior must be restrained in order for the Christian to be pure and chaste. Moreover, Christians should not only seek to refrain from sexual impurities, but also to act positively in fulfilling obligations imposed by sexual freedoms within marriage relationships. So there's the boundaries. But you can see what's happening to our society, the pervasiveness of pornography, the permissiveness of our society. And then if any Christian stands up and says, no, there's a boundary to that, then they're vilified and they're marginalized and they're set aside as being archaic. And so that's just the nature.
Or you're taken out of business.
Yeah.
In some cases, you try to stand up for your values and trying to bake a cake, and all of a sudden you're hiring lawyers.
Nobody said there was not going to be a cost to being a follower of Jesus Christ.
I agree.
And look what Christ suffered and what he went through on our behalf. If we think for a minute that we're going to avoid suffering just because we've claimed the name and we're playing the game, we're sadly mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
That we are going to suffer, but we can be heartened by the fact that we belong to the fellowship of suffering, that Christ suffered for us, and that it's something that's going to be a part of our life. And I think it's already happening in our society. As we talked about, we're being ostracized by society as having saying nothing that has any value, and so we're not listened to. We're being marginalized in our jobs. There are some jobs that we can't even pursue now because of the faith in which we hold. It's not even an issue of whether or not we're going to be verbal about our faith. It's an issue now that we even have that faith. And if we don't condone the behavior, choices of other members of society that we would consider to be objectionable, then we're not hired. We're going to be marginalized, I think, monetarily. I think I'll probably see in my lifetime, for instance, that the tax issue with regard to churches is going to go away. And we're going to have to pay taxes because they're clamoring after more money and revenue. And a lot of churches are sitting on very expensive property that's not providing any tax revenue. So it's just a matter of time before that goes away. So, and it may even be, and I don't want to be too much of an alarmist about this, but it may even be, and I never thought it was going to be possible in my lifetime, that we'll see physical persecution as Christians in pockets around our own country. And there are evidences of that already happening. So the fact of the matter is that first century Christianity is going to be in the 21st century as well in terms of what we're going to have to endure for the cause of Christ. And we need to understand that and be prepared for that.
All right. What about the nature of civilized government?
Okay, the author Wagner said that because humanists believe that man is basically good and that the best informed and wisest of men should rule over them, and we know we're always picking the best and wisest men and women for government, aren't we? We always make
totally.
The right choices.
Yeah.
It follows that for humanists, the rulership of human government should fall upon a small and select group. Moreover, for humanists, the greatest concentrations of power should be at the federal or centralized levels of civil government, with all governments subservient to the federal government. This form of government is called statism. According to the author, it tends to regulate all human activities at every level of society. And look at, again, what's the swing that's taking place on the political spectrum, where more and more people are demanding the government be involved more and more in our lives,
mm-hmm.
and that the government ought to be paying for it, and that the government owes us. And so that kind of socialistic point of view is now becoming acceptable in a country where it was never acceptable in the past. Now, on the other hand, because Christians believe that everyone is a sinner, and because power tends to make people corrupt, and it was Lord Acton says power corrupts and absolute power power corrupts absolutely, it follows that for Christians, it's very dangerous to place extensive powers for governing society into the hands of one person. And that if you read the book of Revelation, you know that the world is going to be moving towards a one-world government, and this Antichrist is going to come to the forefront that's going to provide solutions that heretofore we haven't been able to arrive at. Christians generally believe that the governing of society should be distributed among people, with the greatest governing powers concentrated at the local levels of society, not centralized. So that's the basic difference. But we're still to honor the governments that protect us. So that's the difference.
Yeah. Well, Greg, this has been very interesting. I appreciate you coming in. We only have a minute left. How should Christians respond to secular humanism? Your parting thoughts.
Yes. The true meaning of love scripturally is having a genuine concern for the well-being and welfare of another individual, even if they're unlovable. We may not agree with where a secular humanist is coming from, but Christ first loved us, and he loves them. So we need to respond and act in their best interest, and sometimes that's disagreeing with them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always, it says in Scripture, with respect and reverence. Being open to listen, and again, answering questions they're asking or question answers they're giving, but always being prepared to give a defense for the hope that's in us, to share the testimony of our life, to declare what God's done for us, and to invite them to entertain the possibility of receiving Jesus Christ as their Savior and Lord, because it's the Holy Spirit, as we talked about earlier, that convicts the world of sin, righteousness, and judgment.
Greg, thank you so much for coming in. You'll be going home with the home version of Afternoons with Bill Arnold just for quoting Lord Acton today. That qualifies just fine. Thanks so much. We'll take a little break and be back with Rob Bluey in just a minute. Tuesday, and it is Tuesday. Let's check in with Rob. Hey, Rob.
Hey, it's good to be with you, Bill.
Things are heating up. We're a week away now from the midterms, and it is crazy.
It certainly is. It seems that every day we have a new bombshell that drops today. Of course, everybody in Washington is talking about President Trump's comments on ending birthright citizenship. Of course, that is part of the 14th Amendment, where some people interpret that as if you come to the United States and you're born here, you automatically get citizenship. President Trump obviously believes differently and says that through an executive order, he will be able to put an end to this. Now,
mm-hmm.
Bill, this is one of those things that you just have to – I hope your audience is skeptical enough to realize that this might be a – what they call a trial balloon or a political move to maybe get distract the media for a short period of time, and there's nobody better at doing some of this than President Trump. He certainly knows how to drive a news story, doesn't he?
He really does. Rob, talk this out with me, would you? This this executive order, which he has the ability to do, is to say that if you have if you're an illegal citizen and you come into our country as an illegal citizen, well, you're not a citizen if you're illegal. You come in and have a baby, that child is instantly a U.S. citizen and you have all the rights and privileges. That's what he's pushing against. Is that right?
Correct. He is saying that this has created a situation in the United States that there are things like birth tourism. So, I mean, people will come to the United States around the time that they're due, deliver the baby here. That baby will be a U.S. citizen and for the rest of their life. There's also situations where it's led to an increase in illegal immigration because people will want to come here, have a child, and then once that child is a citizen, which the United States automatically currently recognizes the child as a citizen, that child will later in life be able to help the sponsor the parents, and the parents will become citizens. So there are many ways that the system has been abused, and what you're seeing is, I think, a frustration on the part of President Trump and his administration, who are looking at things like the caravan that continues to make its way through Mexico toward the U.S. border, and they I think, are frustrated with Congress not being able to pass any sort of immigration reform or build a wall along the southern border. So they're going to try to take measures into their own hands.
All right, Rob. So we have a private meeting with Jesus, you and me. What does he say to us about this situation?
You know, I've been thinking a lot about that. So from a Christian standpoint, we certainly want to help those in need, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's important to all of us who believe in Jesus and everything that he taught us. And so I think that this is where you have some conflict about those who believe in a rule of law and having a country defined by borders. You have that conflict, and you want to be able to help. But I'd say ultimately, at the end of the day, this is a country that is governed by a rule of law. And this is an issue, this birthright citizenship, that I expect will not be decided by solely President Trump. It's going to be fought out in the courts. It's going to be probably fought out in the halls of Congress. There's going to be passionate and emotional debates on both sides of the issue. And it's one of the reasons, Bill, that I think that one of the best things that we can advocate for on an international level is the same kind of principles and beliefs that we believe in here in the United States that have led to the prosperity and greatness of our country. Unfortunately, many people in Central and South America don't have those types of circumstances. They're fleeing socialism and other forms of dictatorial governments, and they want to come to the United States and live life here because they see the freedom that we do have.
Well, I appreciate your response, Rob, and I'm also impressed that you and I got a private meeting with Jesus. So that's
well,
you got to admit that's pretty cool, right?
That would be cool.
Yeah. All right, let's go to Pittsburgh and let's talk about what's going on there and all the ways in which the media are being very antagonistic towards the president and his anti-Semitic rhetoric, which I don't know where that comes from, to be honest.
Right. Well, you know, look, we've had the bomb scare, which many Democrats and liberals found these explosive devices in their mailboxes. Days later, we have this terrible shooting at the synagogue in Pittsburgh. And I think that the heightened rhetoric that we're hearing in our country right now leads some people to point fingers and blame. And President Trump, unfortunately, doesn't deserve that blame. I mean, I was personally very disappointed in some of the media coverage that I saw. Obviously, there have been times where, look back at this shooting last year that happened in Alexandria, Virginia, where Steve Scalise, the Republican whip in Congress, was seriously injured. That was a Bernie Sanders supporter. But at the same time, I don't think you saw the same level of media attention and Republican politicians blaming Bernie Sanders for this man's actions like you have seen with President Trump. The other thing to remember in the case of the synagogue shooting is that Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump and their children are Jewish.
Right.
So it doesn't even make sense from a standpoint that the president would be anti-Semitic with his own daughter and grandchildren being practitioners of that faith.
Yeah. Dennis Prager wrote this. He's, of course, a Jewish radio commentator. He said the 90% of the threats were called in by a mentally disturbed American Jewish teenager living in Israel, and the other 10% were made by a black radical seeking to frame his ex-girlfriend. So there's a lot of misunderstood information right now about where the threats are coming from.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct on that, Bill. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I think we as with any election, things obviously become more heated, and the closer we get, the tensions rise. It's important for us to take a step back. I think it's also important for the things that we can do as friends and neighbors, simply, you know, saying hi to somebody, asking them how they're doing today, engaging in that kind of conversation with somebody who might not have the kind of interaction that you and I are blessed to have every day. I mean, I feel very fortunate we're able to communicate to an audience and have that type of conversation. But other people don't, and I think we have to remember that, when we can help a friend or neighbor in need, we should do so.
Mm-hmm. I read a story, and I probably won't recall it exactly like I remember, but the bomb builder, the guy who was just arrested, who sent all the bombs, he was referred to as the loner in 1A or the loner in apartment 1 or something like that. And another woman who lived there said that he learned her name, and he would always greet her by her name. And she said, I didn't quite get his name, and I never called him by his name, and I never reciprocated, you know, that level of kindness. And I don't know, he's probably so mentally disturbed, it's not going to make a difference. But human contact and feeling like you matter and having someone look you in the eye and call you by your name makes a difference, I think.
Oh, I agree. I think you're absolutely right on that. And I think that's, again, one of the things that hopefully we are all able to do is, regardless of our political differences, and trust me, there are great political differences in this country, but my hope is that we can see past that. And again, after next Tuesday, regardless of which party has control of Congress, there are some major issues that we need to confront as a nation. We've been talking about one, which is immigration. Obviously, healthcare continues to top the polls as one of the issues that is on the mind of many Americans. There are two very different paths that the right and the left would take on an issue like that. The economy is fortunately doing very well right now, but we've got some spending challenges. There are some other things that we need to address, and we're going to need people on hopefully both sides of the aisle being able to have a conversation and work through some of these problems and get to a solution.
Mm-hmm. Rob, can we talk about healthcare just a little bit? Because if I remember correctly, the repeal and replace that the Republicans wanted to do included pre-existing conditions. So that was going to be part of the repeal and replace. Do I have that right?
Yes. Just let me ask to clarify. When you say was going to be part of it, meaning that they were going to maintain pre-existing conditions?
Yes.
Correct. There is probably nothing aside from providing health care to 26-year-olds that's more popular than the pre-existing conditions. So Republicans politically, I think long ago, recognized that was one piece of Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, that they would not be able to touch.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking that when Senator McCain voted it down, which was essentially killing it, I can't remember. What was so offensive to him in that bill that he couldn't live with?
Well, see, and that's the thing about McCain's vote that to this day is something that we keep coming back to. He was upset that it didn't go through the normal regular order or the process where it would have the level of debate and input that senators would normally provide. It was something that was really crafted behind closed doors so often, as legislation usually is. And I think that was one of the things that was motivating his no vote in that particular case. Now, there could have been other policy provisions that he didn't like about the bill, but that was one of the signature things that he said. And remember, it was one of those things where when McCain walked into the chamber that day, there were a lot of people who felt he was going to vote in favor of this repeal and replace plan, and ultimately he decided to go against it. And it's left us in a situation now where we have fewer choices for many Americans. Costs, again, going up. I think year after year, Americans are faced with higher health care costs. And you have a proposal on the left, Bernie Sanders and others advocating Medicare for all and more of a socialized medicine approach. And you have conservatives who want to return more power back to the states and consumers. So how we reach a solution on this, particularly if we have divided government, I do not know. But it's one of those things where Republicans could attempt, Bill, to bring this back up in the lame duck session of Congress and try to accomplish something there.
Boy, a week from now, it's going to be real interesting. It's interesting that the networks are practically treating it like a presidential election. It's such a big deal.
Well, and I think in part because we know what some of the ramifications and implications of the election will be. There are several Democrats who are ready to move forward with impeachment proceedings against President Trump. We can probably expect many of them to push that next Wednesday if they do take control of Congress. And you're already seeing Nancy Pelosi outline some of the first bills that she would introduce if she were elected Speaker of the House in January. So I think that that's why, because no one really knows what the outcome is going to be, it's led to this dramatic moment in which we're all waiting with anticipation about how things will turn out.
Okay, Rob, I have three burning questions I'm going to ask, but I'm going to do it after the break. Rob Bluey is my guest. He's editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal. Go to dailysignal.com to see his website. We'll take a very short break and be right back. Welcome back to the show. I have on my studio line Rob Bluey. He's the editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal. Love the Daily Signal. Go to dailysignal.com to check it out. Rob, right before we went to break, we were talking about what's going to be going on a week from tomorrow, which is the day after the midterm election. And you talk about early discussion of impeachment. Can you tell me why they would – what basis would they be trying to impeach him on?
Well, this is the remarkable thing about this. I attended a conference here in Washington not too long ago, and I heard Al Green, who's a congressman from Texas, speak about this. And he makes the case that you actually don't need to have a crime. The president doesn't have to have committed any crimes for impeachment to go forward. And he actually has a history of citing examples of where this took place, obviously not on the presidential level. And so I think that there isn't we could find ourselves in a situation where there's not a clear-cut case where President Trump was obviously guilty of anything, but it's just a matter of they don't like him and his policies, and therefore they're going to move forward with impeachment. And I think that's dangerous. That's certainly not how I believe impeachment was meant to be. The important thing to remember about impeachment, though, is it does take both houses of Congress. So the House, as it did under Bill Clinton in 1998, I believe, voted to impeach him. That then moved to the Senate, where you had to have two-thirds of senators vote to convict him in order to remove him from office. And, of course, they fell short. Republicans fell short of that number, and Clinton remained in office. And I think the same is likely going to be true for Trump if we were to go down this road. There's no way the Democrats would come close to having the two-thirds, which is 67 senators, in order to be able to convict him.
Mm-hmm. Rob, and then you had mentioned about Nancy Pelosi. If she became Speaker again, she's got some bills she's clamoring to get going on. What are those?
Yeah, so one of them is what she's describing as a campaign finance reform bill. So the left and Democrats in particular have complained for years about the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. They don't like that decision because they believe that it's opened up too many independent outfits to participate in the political process. So they would like to have more restrictions on who's allowed to fund various campaigns, and so that would be a top priority. A second thing is gun background checks. They obviously were not able to advance any legislation after some of the recent school shootings, so this is an area where they would like to see some movement. They want to provide an amnesty for Dreamers. Again, we go back to immigration. So Dreamers are those people who came here and are in this kind of, they have the status that President Obama conferred on them through, again, an executive order. And, you know, it's one of those matters where they're living in the country with this protection, but it's never been approved by Congress. So she wants to have Congress weigh in and make a statement. And then finally, you know, most recently, she's talked about having some protections for the LGBT community. She said that she would introduce something called the Equality Act, and it would add sexual orientation and gender identity to the list of protected classes in federal civil rights law. So that it does, that last one has, you know, serious consequences for religious liberty, as we've seen adjudicated at the Supreme Court, most recently with Jack Phillips in his case. He was the baker from Colorado. So these are just a handful of things that that Pelosi is planning to champion if she were elected speaker. And you can imagine, Bill, that there's going to be a whole number of other issues that the Democrats will attempt to do probably within those first days, because that's when really they have the greatest momentum and energy. Of course, many of them will go nowhere, particularly if Republicans retain control of the Senate and with a president in the White House who is likely to veto them.
Mm-hmm. Rob, is the military deploying troops to the border? Is that talk or is that already happening?
That's what they say they're doing. Now, you know, we're actually planning to send our foreign correspondent, Nolan Peterson, to accompany the caravan. We're hoping to do that in the coming days so the Daily Signal can have somebody on the ground. Of course, Nolan has spent time both in the military and on the front lines of the war between Russia and Ukraine. So Bill, I don't have any firsthand knowledge that the troops are there, but from everything we hear, yes, troops are headed there to the border to provide the reinforcements. So if the caravan were to arrive, there would be somebody there to greet him. Remember, you have to be on U.S. soil to be able to claim asylum. So okay. I think that the goal of President Trump and his administration is to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, and I assume the military wants to just be a presence there and puff their chests out, but they don't want any violence, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that would be disastrous if it resorted to violence. And it's hard to say, you know, with up to 7,000 people as part of this caravan, who they are. And I know that President Trump has said that there are some bad actors associated with them. This is one of the reasons we want to go there and see with our own eyes and report for the Daily Signal, because I think it's really valuable for the more people who can get down there. I think, you know, we've seen obviously the TV networks, the cable TV networks, you know, have people embedded or walking alongside them. You know, that's fine, but as you know from TV, you get a 30-second clip, and that's about the extent of it. So what we're hoping to do, Bill, is to be able to better understand why they're coming here, what's motivating them, who's funding it, you know, what it is they want when they do reach the border. Mexico has made steps to keep them in its country. Of course, they made steps to, you know, block them at its border. So it's hard to say. We don't know where they're going to arrive yet. Will it be California? Will it be Texas? But those are all unanswered questions. And it's probably not going to happen before Election Day. You know, at the pace that they're going, it'll happen probably sometime in November.
Mm-hmm. Rob, let me throw out a cliche and have you respond. All right, this midterm is the most important midterm election of our lifetimes.
We hear that every time there's an election, whether it's a presidential election or a midterm election. If you're running for office and your livelihood depends on it, then you're absolutely going to say that. I mean, let's face it, that's what you hear from candidates all the time. They feel that now is the most important election. The fact of the matter is, I don't think this is probably – I think there are significant consequences, but we're blessed to live in a time of mostly peace. You know, I can think of other midterm elections when we were at war. Think back to 2002, which was the first election after 9/11. I mean, that was probably a midterm election where you had significant consequences at stake. There have been others. Just in recent memory, 2006, when Democrats retook control of Congress and put a check on President Bush's final 2 years, and then 4 years later in 2010 when the Tea Party rose and put a check on Obama. So we shall see how this one ultimately plays out, but I don't know that I'd call it the most consequential in history.
All right. Let's talk about just the importance of the Christian vote in this midterm election.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, they are this is a group of people who in many respects surprised a lot of the pundits and prognosticators when they turned out in droves for President Trump in 2016. He made many appeals to the group, doing things that were probably a little bit uncomfortable for a president who didn't necessarily identify with his religious beliefs or his faith, but went before Christian voters, evangelicals, to talk about issues that he knew that they cared about passionately. And I think that's one of the things that that's going to be interesting to watch, if with him not on the ballot, if that group is going to turn out. I think that's true for a number of different groups. You have the same type of questions about it's in a couple of states there are African American candidates on the ballot, Georgia and Florida. Will those candidates be boosted by that presence? We certainly saw that was true when President Obama ran for office. He attracted a certain segment of the population that maybe traditionally didn't turn out. So how Christians what Christians decide to do could make or break how things turn out on Election Day.
Mm-hmm. Where is the energy right now? Is it on the Republican side or the Democratic side?
Oh, it seems to fluctuate every day,
okay.
Bill. I mean, I'll tell you, I mean, after the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, it seemed that Republicans had the enthusiasm and the energy. I think that that's that energy has remained. Early voting is a thing that we're doing now. So, I mean, people have already cast their ballots, and I think in that case, that's why Republicans in some states have an early lead in that early voting situation. But with the back and forth, it's hard to say who's got the edge. I think it's going to come right down to next Tuesday when people hopefully take part in their civic duty and cast a ballot.
Mm-hmm. Rob, when you drive around your neighborhood, are there a lot of political signs in yards?
I would say it's more subdued this year than it has been in past. Speaking about Virginia specifically, the Senate race isn't a contest. I mean, it's Tim Kaine is the incumbent and Corey Stewart is the Republican. It's probably not much of a race. And the congressional district I live in is overwhelmingly controlled by Democrats, so that could be a factor. I will say this, Bill. I've seen probably more Beto O'Rourke signs, who's running for Senate in Texas in my neighborhood,
wow.
than I have for the candidates running for Senate in Virginia. And it just goes to, I think, to show how, in some cases, these elections can become nationalized. Despite what you might say about the local issues dominating so many communities, in some cases, they really are about national politics.
Mm-hmm. Rob, what race results are you most anticipating? When you mentioned Beto O'Rourke, that's going to be an interesting one. But what are your top three that you can't wait to find out what happens?
Well, I think the states that we'll be looking closely at are some of those closely contested ones, such as Tennessee, where you have a closely watched Senate race, Ohio, which is always a bellwether state, where the governor's race is on display there, and then of course the show me state of Missouri, which you have another Senate race, and Missouri is historically always one of those states that has been a bellwether, not so much recently. But hey, right there in Minnesota, you've got a highly contested attorney general's race and a couple of congressional seats that might be one of the few bright spots for Republicans. So we'll be keeping an eye on all of it.
Bright spot, Republicans in Minnesota. Those almost words almost never go together. Rob, thanks so much for coming on to the show. I'm dying to talk to you next Tuesday, but then even more so a week from Tuesday, 2 weeks from today. So that'll be fun.
That's right. Well, yeah. We'll be following it closely at the Daily Signal.
I know
so
you will.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you so much. Rob Blue, he's been my guest, editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal. Go to dailysignal.com. That's all the time we have. Have a great night, everyone. See you tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.